And good afternoon. It is 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, in the first hour, from an October 29th event in that was held in Watson Hall here at Queen's University, you'll hear Kingston Poet Laureate Sadiqa Day Meyer deliver her page lecture called In the Field. And in that is in the annual series that's held at Queen's. She was introduced by Sam McKegney, who is the head of the Queen's Department of English. I will let you know that happening again this week is that this segment does run a bit over an hour. So it will, though, air in its entirety. It won't break when the second hour comes up, just to take care of all that stuff after. And so, it will air uninterrupted, probably about, 10 to 15 minutes into the second hour, I believe. So in the second hour then, and beginning then, of course, 10 to 15 minutes into it, you're going to hear from a December 3rd event at Novel Idea Bookstore, a launch. You'll hear Julie Selverson reading from and launching A Necessary Distance, Confessions of a Scriptwriter's Daughter. She was introduced that evening by Carolyn Smart. And it is almost 2 minutes at this point after 4 o'clock. And I'll just mention briefly that you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. And just to let you know, I don't think it's an issue at all today, but my usual hourly announcement occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. So let's go ahead and just jump into, again, an October 29th event that was held at Queen's Hall here at Queen's. You'll hear Sadiqa Day Meyer deliver her page lecture again called In the Field. And that, again, in case you missed it at the very top of the hour, is an annual series that's held every fall at Queen's. And she was introduced by Sam McKegney, who is the head of the Queen's Department of English. And as I mentioned, too, at the very top of the hour, in case you missed it, this will run a bit into the second hour, but will run without interruption. That said, let's go ahead and just jump right into it.
Afternoon, everyone. This is an incredible turnout. Holy smokes. It is amazing to look into a room of such excited literary aficionados waiting to be inspired and challenged. My name is Sam. I'm the head of the English department, and I'm really excited to welcome you to this year's page lecture in honor of the Kingston poet and visual artist Joanne Page. The page lecture is a time that I value every year, and it's one of those, I honestly have to say, it's one of those rare moments in our department where the interface between the university space and the community space of literary lovers dissolves, and we have such a diverse and delightful community here in this room. This may be the most packed one that I've seen. Which is pretty cool. This is going to be a day of looking backward, looking to the ground beneath our feet to where we are this moment, and a day of looking forward. I think I told Steve one time that I came here as a student in 1999, and I don't think until this year we were able to use that balcony out there. And I've been looking forward to the Page Lecture where we get to open up those doors and have a drink out of that balcony, and that's today. So thinking a little bit about looking backward and looking, you know, to a bit of history, Carolyn Smart's in the room with us today, the long-serving shepherd of our creative writing program, building from what Bronwyn Wallace commenced, and thinking to how it is currently flourishing and where it's going is pretty exciting to me personally. On the tables in front of you, you'll find a collection of several of the Page Lectures that have been given over the 12 years in which the Page Lecture has been in existence. Those have been kindly provided by and created by Maureen Harris. So a great amount of gratitude to Maureen. They're really beautiful. And you know, if you already have, you know, two of the copies that are in front of you, please give them to someone, right? Make sure they find a home. Thinking to the future, on January 1st, 2025, our department goes from being called the Department of English Language and Literature at Queen's to the Department of English Literature and Creative Writing. And that move is intended to signal the mutual generativity of the creative and the critical in what we do. The great Cree poet Louise Half, I remember her telling me one time, we were talking about gender, and she was talking about how men and women are, you know, cannot be thought of apart. And she said, we are intimate, like muscle and bone. And I think about creative production and study in that fashion. The greatest creative work emerges from meticulous attention, careful reading, and engaged study of the world. The greatest critical work is of necessity creative, emboldened by imagination and leaning into wonder. And that's very much the vision that we have for our department and what we need to do in the world. And this is the vision that the Joanne Page Lecture has had for over a decade. As an esteemed Canadian literary artist is brought to Queen's campus to reflect on craft, process, product, purpose, the critical and the creative. And at this time when AI and social media threaten to flatten and obfuscate our humanity, this is when the arts and humanities are most urgently needed. Here in Kingston, Cataraqui and surrounding area, the lands of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy and of the Anishinaabe Nation, we are blessed with an abundance of creative artists, something Joanne knew well and certainly nurtured. This year, the Department of English Literature and Creative Writing is honoring the literary vibrancy of these territories. One way we're doing that is working to expand our Writers in the Community program, one of whom is here. I saw Sarah Jan here earlier. We're also very, very excited to welcome multi-award-winning poet and novelist Nancy Jo Cullen as our Carolyn Smart Writer in Residence in the new year. So that will be starting right at the end of January and into March. And we're also excited to initiate with Kingston Writers Fest and the Alperdi A-Frame the Stephen Hyten Residency, which is an initiative that provides support for a creative artist at any stage of their career who is embarking on a radical departure from what they produce to date. And it will involve a multi-week residency at the A-Frame, a one-week residency at Queen's, and will culminate in an event at Kingston Writers Fest. I also note that Kingston's own Helen Humphreys has recently agreed to be the Director of Creative Writing for our department. And so we're in a very, very special place of cementing and nurturing these relationships with the creative community here. Which brings me to today's Page Lecturer, who to many in this audience will require no introduction. Sadiqa De Meyer is Kingston's Poet Laureate and current writer-in-residence at York University. She is the recipient of the CBC Poetry Prize, ARC's Poem of the Year Award, a Jean Royce Fellowship, and a Governor General's Award. a literary threat across genres and who weaves genres together. She has been a finalist for Governor General's Awards in both poetry and nonfiction. And her forthcoming book is an essay collection with lyric dimensions. Her work explores landscape, families, inner lives, parental duties, and the long wakes of colonialism and migration. Her published pieces include Alphabet, Alphabet, A Memoir of a First Language, 2020 from Palimpsest, and the collections of poems, The Outer Wards from Vehicle Press 2020, and Leaving Howe Island from Oolacan Books in 2013. Her page lecture today is entitled In the Field. Please join me in welcoming Poet Laureate Sadiqa Demeyer.
All right, thank you for that introduction, Sam. And welcome everyone. I'm really glad to see you all here. Excited to give the inaugural balcony lecture. And of all the setups I pictured, I didn't really imagine being flanked by two screens, but it's nice, exciting. I think you could like imagine that the two halves of my brain are doing the same thing at once or something. All right, I'm going to start with a bit of an introduction of my own. It's a lecture, so get really comfortable. I used to have trouble sitting through these things when I was in school, so I don't mind if you stretch or lay down on your table. Whatever you need to do. In the field. I remember only one conversation with Joanne Page, although we saw each other before and after. This encounter was at the edge of City Park in Kingston. She squinted against the sun and said, "We read your essay. We all read it and thought it was really good. We were surprised at how good it was." She was on the organizing committee of Common Magic, a conference celebrating the life and work of Bronwyn Wallace. I had submitted a piece about reading Wallace's work during my early years of living in Kingston, and I had called it Arguments with the White World. I picture that moment at the park. It seems like a lifetime ago. Sir John A. was on his pedestal, and the idea of his communally enacted removal would have seemed a speculative fiction. I picture it now and can almost see the dimensions of what we didn't know or say, revolving slowly in the air between us. I didn't know that Joanne was the one who named Bronwyn Wallace's essay collection, Arguments with the World, that my title played with hers. I had read and admired Joanne's poetry, finding an embodied awareness in it of where we lived, but was having the experience that facing a writer you like can shake blank the etch-a-sketch of your mind. She was extending a form of welcome into a Kingston writing community, and I didn't know if I wanted that. I mean, I didn't know if it would feel like community or a differently familiar space where someone like myself might be conspicuous and invisible at once and occupied with efforts of translation. What I also didn't know and learned later through the page lectures themselves, was that our methodologies held common ground, were common magic. That we both painted with watercolors and made unusual maps, and drafted our poems on big pages so that we could revise around their edges. It was a short conversation, and we didn't truly find each other then. But here we are now. I do believe that Joanne is here. And I want to thank her and her family and the Department of English for the honor of presenting a lecture in her name. This is a painting by Canadian artist Margot Williamson. A is for Apple. Alphabet, abstraction. It probably began when you were small, when moving a pencil across paper was still a matter of subduing the animate creature that was your fist, your initiation into literacy. If the alphabet was English, M was a bird in flight, Y a slingshot and a question. The song made a glued bundle of LMNOP. And do you remember the mountainous efforts, the initial impossibility of turning clusters of letters into sense? I don't recall the work of it, but in my family's mythology, I learned from a girl named Helene. We were neighbors in a building where the stairwells reeked of cigarettes and urine, except on Tuesdays when it was bleach. Their apartment was identical to ours and unrecognizable through its furnishings, so crossing the threshold felt like entering a dream. Some parts of the rooms were off limits to children. I believe it was all children, and not a rule invoked only when brown ones came over. They had a poodle who nipped. Helene was a year older than I was, therefore indisputably in charge. After school, we played school, and she repeated her grade one lessons to me. What I do recollect of that early reading is that once I could, I no longer couldn't. From the back seat of our car, I fixated on store names, road signs, car brands, license plates. Text gained primacy in my attention, meaning that I read the human in position on the landscape first. I saw that sequences of place names were a form of poetry, that kilometers diminished slowly, that a woodlot could be for sale. In Dutch, that was the language. BV can mean, for example, as I was told, or incorporated. I saw the signs for factories sweep past and thought, no, I didn't think this. I had a feeling, one that I'm articulating now. I felt that their real names were volatile secrets, changing so fast that they could only display examples. What words displaced was my reading of the world itself. When it rained, the drops had streaked so intriguingly across the glass, finding each other and merging, but now they blurred what I wanted to see. Literature, as a medium, might operate on this inherent circularity, the same gesture as curse and cure. Reading draws our consciousness away from the sensory imprints of the world, and then seeks to instill them again, to offer the phrase that makes us say, yes, that is it. That is the sudden moon between two clapboard houses on a summer night. This is what my earliest writing looked like. In other words, I started to write before I knew what writing was. And then I continued. So, I have entered the space of this lecture as a chance to take a breath between essays, between the fast and turbulent days, between symbol and effect, and ask myself, what is it? Any answer will be in the shadows that are flickering on the ground. Because what we know about enormous, improbable, incandescent spheres is that we should not look at them directly for too long. People have written on stone, clay, wood, bark, leaves, wax, animal hides, fabric, paper, screens. They've used fingers, mallets, sticks, knives, bones, chalk, feathers, reeds, pens, keyboards. Material determines form. If you are carving letters into surfaces of stone or clay, curved lines take greater effort. If you scrape your script onto palm leaves, as people did in the south of India, then longer horizontal lines will split the leaf along the vein, making rounded, discrete characters preferable. On a flat surface, horizontal writing is more comfortable, while a wall or easel works well for vertical scripts. If you write with ink, then moving in vertical rows from top to bottom, and right to left if you're left-handed, left to right if you're not, will prevent smudging. The direction of the writing is a practical matter, and then it comes to influence how you conceive of time itself. In the script of the Roman alphabet that English and Dutch both use, we find that time is a rightward effort against a windstorm. When your hand drops, it blows back to the left, and you proceed again. Or the lines might be the days, and the wordless spaces between them, nights. In Arabic and Shamukhi Punjabi, two of my father's languages, as well as in numerous others, writing takes the opposite direction. Here, Egyptian illustrator Mohideen Elabad describes the difference that makes in whether a character is arriving or leaving. Writing that turns in continuity back and forth across the page, like Etruscan and the earliest Greek, and presently the Avoyili language of Vanuatu, is called Boustrophedon, which means as an ox-drawn plow moves. At school, once we had learned to write in pencil, we were given a fountain pen. Mine was turquoise with a pink cap. Pressing too hard would flatten the nib, and I had to write slowly. There was a kind of consent between pen and paper. The pen touched and waited for the paper to draw the ink down. I still have slow pens and fast pens. The pilot fineliner is for when the cursive matters. A letter or card, lines from other writers, the title of a new work. The big ballpoint is for quick, furtive notes or first drafts, for when writing feels like taking a fast dictation from my own mind. There is a writer I love who was able to write quickly with a fountain pen, Etty Hillesum, a Dutch Jewish student of psychology and Slavic languages, on whom the war was closing in. Great inhibitions, she wrote as she began her journals. I don't dare to give things away, to let them stream from me freely. Her journals and letters were published 36 years after the occupation ended. My mother bought the book. We lived in that apartment building then, beside Helene. What I didn't like at school was the convention for marking our errors, a dot on either side of the word or phrase and a line below. The thing you hadn't meant to say or spell became a beacon in the waves of text. But maybe this is inescapable. The verso side, the left page, as Dion Brandt taught us in The Blue Clerk, speaking through all you've intended. I sense its presence even as I savor the freedom of obliterating words that aren't working, circling my pen over them until my drafts are full of little storm clouds or look like jack pines with dark, sideward branches. So much of writing is that sieving between what comes and what is allowed to stay. I was in grade 2 and bored, watching the clock drive through its minutes. I took out a piece of paper and wrote down the names of all my classmates, followed by a character sketch. My descriptions were wayward and strange. I wrote that Lisette had the soul of a light gray horse, that Remco was itchy inside his knees and would someday watch his brother get injured. I felt alive, magnificent, my body flooding with a stream of stars. A voice that was and wasn't mine was flowing through my hands. Then I saw a boy named Nico glance at me and look away. That's all. And I realized what I was holding. A dangerous, damning document. A social disaster I found and read. My pulse tripped on itself. Writing was your mind outside your body. It was that underground river of observation and conjecture and intuition spilled out for others to find. I crumpled the paper into as small a ball as possible, and later in the bathroom I soaked it under the tap and threw the wet scrap in the garbage. I have no doubt that everything on that page was true, true past the realm of facts. And I wasn't ready to be held responsible for what it said. On fate, on the notion of a brother getting hurt, my father might say, it is written, the literal translation of the Arabic word maktoub. This was meant as reassurance. Everything that is going to happen has already been written down by God, so accept it when it comes. I had questions that I didn't ask him. Was this vast document a scroll, a book, a cosmic non-substance? Where could it be found? How detailed did it get? Did God ever make changes? Were there passages that got marked with two dots and underlined so that they wouldn't happen after all? And then the inevitable philosophical conundrum, what of our free will? Later, through reading and conversation with others, I found there was a mitigating answer to that last query. In Arabic calligraphy, a single word may take an almost endless number of forms. The artist gives the text its shape, squared, fluent, compact, sprawling, graceful, jagged. Our futures may be written, but we determine how. So then, the aesthetics of writing are the aesthetics of living. This lecture was written. I wrote it in a series of rooms that have left their quiet tracks. The kitchen was sunlit, and my mind accelerated. The chair was uncomfortable, and I disputed with myself. I answered the door, and a phrase was lost to me. I used the fast pen, my fingers pushed buttons. Knowing that the text would be read out loud, I wrote differently than I would for an essay. Because you, as a listener, cannot insert your own pauses or read the same line two or three times over. You are hearing my past sentences in a place I didn't make them, describing occurrences from another millennium and country. Writing is miraculous in its dissembling of space and time. I couldn't tell you what I intended without it, because my mind is unpracticed in what an oral culture would require. We live where settlers attempted for hundreds of years to eliminate orally transmitted languages like Ojibwe and Kanyin-Kihaka. And this was also a violence against the profound linguistic capacities of their speakers. Writing is rigid. Even its notations enact this, as Julie Sedevi observes in her book, Linguafile. She says, children have to train their minds to believe that an object is strictly bound to a certain orientation. Learning that the lowercase p and b and d are different things is like asking the mind to believe that a cup becomes a different object if it is laid upside down or with its handle facing left instead of right. If I wasn't reading, I could make my words responsive to this instant, to you who are present here this afternoon. the written obscures that we exist in the fluidity of our experience and favors instead the absolutes, the uniform, the rule. Documents and books place the archive of memory outside our bodies. We ourselves are emptier for them. And writing implies that we will be apart, not in each other's company often enough or long enough to share the stories of which we are made. You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read, James Baldwin said. In my case, you read James Baldwin, and you feel the nearness of a loving and visionary spirit. Writing can do that. But first, you had to be very alone. This is a picture taken in artist Ruth Asawa's house. Asawa created various forms of art, but the motif of these wire sculptures became her signature. Here is one alone. Until her Japanese-American family was separated and confined to internment camps, Asawa was raised on a small farm in California. As a child, Ruth would sit on the tailgate of a horse-drawn wagon with her father at the reins and let her feet drag on the ground, bringing them close and apart so that they left long, symmetrical, undulant lines in the dust. This was the origin of the sculptural shape that compelled her for the rest of her life. I imagine the smell of the horse, the friction under her toes, the interval of rest after labor, when her consciousness settled into that spacious receptiveness. Writing consists only partly of writing. There are also the hours of reading, observing, and wool gathering, quietly circling the page itself. In the back seat of my parents' car, I like to put my finger on the window and write long cursive words on the pastures. I wanted the seat on the right because then I was writing into what had passed instead of what was coming, which felt like the proper orientation. Decades later, I stood at the edge of a field that was blank with snow, and I felt that old urge to write on it. The following summer, I was able to follow through on the impulse. I was considering that languages, in the places of their inception, are intimate with land, attuned in structure and pitch and vocabulary to local ecologies. I had grown up in that kind of language and wrote about the moment that I realized this in Alphabet, Alphabet. My language was unequivocally guilty. I was referring there to its colonial imposition. But it also mattered that I'd acquired it on the flat turf of its formation. Until then, I had attributed the sense of detachment I experienced in English, that sensation of having a tongue infused with lidocaine, to the language's belated integration in my life. Now I was in doubt. Perhaps English felt less real because I was speaking it on the wrong land. I was, for the new project, considering that English is my instrument, that it was affixed to this land with fences, that the ground itself was crowded with species who had arrived in conjunction with the language. And I was aware that we, in its encompassing and contemporary sense, the Anishinaabe and the Haudenosaunee and other local indigenous peoples, the settlers with lineages here, the settlers who, like myself, carry in us places where English was forced on our ancestors, we have to reckon with this field. I wrote in the fence with unaccustomed gestures, working strips of cloth through a metal loom and slowly felt myself and the land draw closer. Dragonflies perched on the brighter fabrics. Spiders inspected my weaving. Rain fell and tightened the knots. But what strikes me now, when I look at these pictures, is the abstraction. When René Magritte claims Sistine et Pleasant Peak, at least we're cast into some doubt. Writing is emphatically not the thing, particularly in phonetic alphabets, where the text bears no resemblance to what it signifies. Working in this gap, I think writers often wish, to find the words that will embody what they represent. If you write as the ox plows, I was curious, what is an ox actually? And what would that mean as the writing hand? I found that oxen are castrated male cattle meant to be docile, and told myself I'd reached the end of the metaphor. If you write in the Boustrophedon manner, your pen might not lift from the page at all. The technique of blind contour drawing works that way. You draw in one continuous line while keeping your eyes fixed on your subject. This prevents the distortions that enter the work during the short intervals of memory we rely on whenever our gaze moves down to the paper. In the resulting drawings, elements are superimposed. The line connects parts that are visually separate, and recognizable details flow into confounding forms. It is a portraiture in which the subject comes to us simultaneously distorted and faithful to itself. Even as I long for the equivalent gesture in my own medium, the phrases that come closest to following the contours of the observed, I love literature for the deeper encounter with suggestion that it asks us to make. The ox pulls the plow, seeds drop in the furrow. They germinate in the weather of the reader's mind. A symbol blossoms into meaning. In this field, each of us generates our own private flowers. Elabat, the illustrator, mentions that Arabic books traditionally had a wide and welcoming margin for readers to converse in writing with the text. What reading elicits is, on neurological imaging, difficult to distinguish from experience itself. We read the word lilac or chai, and the olfactory cortex flares. The phrase, "I pulled the cloth strip through the wire fence," will spur the reader's motor cortex as if it were the movement. Or, as Dion Brand wrote, books leave certain gestures in the body, a certain way of moving, of turning, a certain closing of the eyes, a way of leaving, hesitations. Books leave certain sounds, a certain pacing. Mostly, they leave the elusive, which is all the story. Immersive reading, that collaborative solitude, shapes our consciousness. In that sense, we do live what is written. It is through Etty Hillison's journals and letters that I have felt closest to grasping what writing means. Encoding language onto a surface loosens us from the limitations of space and time. She wrote her last postcard on the train to Auschwitz and pushed it out between the wooden slats. A farmer found it and put it in the mail. Our earliest landscapes persist in our written voices, as the farmland around Deventer did in hers. Here she is daydreaming of a writing room. bookshelves along the wall, and a view of grain fields. They have to be grain fields after all. And they also have to move in waves. Writing that traces the present as closely as possible will be inherently retrospective and prescient. In passages where Hillison describes the effects of the Shoah on her communities, the current terrors in Gaza seem to dwell near the surface, and she is already trying to revise that future. Hillison knew viscerally that writing is a form of witnessing. In the barracks of Westerbork, a Dutch concentration camp, she overheard others agreeing that they didn't want to think or feel anymore, or they would go mad. Laat mij dan het denkende hart van deze barak mogen zijn, she wrote. Then let me be the thinking heart of these barracks. Years ago, I was in Amsterdam, sitting on a bench with coffee and my notebook, waiting for the Jewish Historical Museum to open so that I could see the journals. Someone in denim passed by on a cargo bike that held two cheerful children. A van with an image of wheat sheaves reversed into an alley. In an apartment, a cleaning crew polished the windows. A duck landed noisily in the canal. I felt the weight of the responsibility then, that the page, a lasting record within the elapsing world, was in my hands. All our writing, whether philosophical, critical, poetic, erotic, investigative, humorous, or speculative, occurs on behalf of more than the self. What I knew of writing when I first started out has held. That words are mysterious entities, and it takes practice to work with them. And when a voice comes that seems urgent and oracular and only obliquely my own, inconveniently, at the sink, or at 3 a.m, I will feel restless until I get it on the page. But now, I also know the page is never really blank to start. Each writer faces their own version. Everything you've ever read or listened to is waiting there. What your ancestors experienced, the thing you wish to forget, the history of your language, whether or not it has a word for you. We have to nourish multiplicities of writers to make a literature that says enough. The page is as blank as a field in spring. You take a breath of that mud-scrubbed air, acknowledge all the presences, and break the ground open. Thank you.
Such a packed house, it'll be a pain in the neck to get a microphone around to people. So Sadiqa has said she'd answer a few questions.
I can repeat your question.
And so if we could just belt them out when they're ready. But does anyone have a burning question on the tip of your tongue? Ruth, please.
I'm not sure if this is a question, but I love your talk. And my field is all English literature. I don't know if you've read the riddles, but everything you said resonated with the Old English riddles, which are based on, many of them, on the physicality of writing, and then writing a riddle, and then swallowing the words sometimes. There's a whole interplay in those riddles that deals with, yeah, the physicality and the idea of the word, and it just struck me that exactly what you were saying was just resonating perfectly with that.
Will you write that?
I can give you a reference.
I'd
like to see those. Yeah. Thanks.
Speaking of, if I could ask one, I was really struck, well, there's a number of turns of phrase that you use that really stuck with me, but two that I'd like to put into conversation were something along the lines of writing being an archive that we get external to the ourselves, and we are emptier for it. And then later, the idea of sort of awakening with this burning thing that needs to get written down, and then there's a satisfaction in that writing. Both of those seem to be in conversation, but I've often thought of the getting the thing out as being fulfilling rather than emptying out. You know what I mean? That there's a satisfaction that is a feedback loop. I just wondered, I guess my question is my feeling of the making external being fulfilling, is that misunderstanding what you were saying, or is it the same idea?
Yeah, that's not a misunderstanding. No, I agree. Like, it's almost, yeah, there is a sense of fulfillment in getting it down on the page and being able to work with it. I mean, I don't know exactly how that works as far as writing. As we know it, I think it's been with us about 6,000 years. And so we are in a longer term interaction with it, but that's short for evolutionary history, right? And when I think of other artistic media, we have maybe more natural entry points, dance, or singing into music, or, you know, making an image is pretty primal. And children, language-wise, like, they'll learn to speak and listen to language without instruction. Even if they're just around it and you totally neglect a child otherwise, they will learn it. But writing is not like that. Like, someone has to show us. There's no other, nobody learns it spontaneously. And so, yeah, it is, I think there is a bit of artifice to the medium, and yet at the same time, obviously some of us are drawn to it in a way that feels very natural and, you know, and runs deep. Yeah.
I really see some of the ideas of Derrida, specifically like Plato's forms, reflected throughout your paper, like, when you say that writing was at once like a cure and a curse or something to that effect. But it's really interesting how you kind of complicate it, where like going beyond the idea that writing creates an established version of events, that writing can also sort of change the way that you look at the world. Like, I was really drawn to like that description of looking out the window as a child. I think that's something that it can be pretty universal, that way in which words can take primacy over other things like the rest of the thing.
Thank you.
Jordan. Hi, I was thinking about the way you described the conditions of the writing, the materials, and how that affected the form. And I was wondering if there is metaphorically that's a way of considering how experience is sort of defined by certain histories and certain environmental conditions. Like, you're speaking of the land in which the Dutch language sort of came out of, and how that conditioned it, and how colonial imposition sort of throws that into disarray. So I was wondering is there a way of thinking of experiencing and of writing as coming out of maybe doing something inspirational that breaks out of the sort of material that you can that is presented to you. I don't know if you have an example in the materials that you were discussing, or if there's like a larger sort of idea outside of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and the first thing that comes to mind for me is what some people are doing in poetry, you know, when I think of Achmese or Lindgren's work or Kai's here. Kai, like, there are many examples of Julianne, like, where poetry is, I think, working at those edges and, in fact, trying to, through the language, reclaim those connections or heal them in a way that it may not be the explicit agenda of that each poem, but that's what it's working towards, I think, is making language like functional for us again in locations where it has entered as violence, right? Yeah, which is some of what I was thinking about as well in a more, you know, in that installation. Does that address what you're asking?
Yeah, sounds like a little bit like a process of dealing with turning violence into something.
Yeah.
Something
that's right. And even in places where, you know, the language has been continuous for a long time, like when I think of the Dutch language, there's this poem by Ramsay Nasser, who was Dutch poet laureate for some years, but he is a Palestinian Dutch writer. And he wrote in a Dutch of the future. As he's based in Rotterdam, which is a city that, you know, has its own kind of idiom. And he integrated with streams of ethnicities of Dutch, like local Dutch, like Suriname Dutch speakers, Turkish Dutch speakers, and he put it all together into this new Dutch that is quite plausible. Possibly it will sound like that in 2050, but it's richer. It has a lot more going on in it, and then ironically he uses it in an anti-immigrant rant in the poem, you know. But like it's a pretty brilliant act of the imagination. So I guess it's true anywhere, really, because the world is, you know, I think it's new all over the place as far as who's living where, right? So, yeah.
Thank you.
This isn't really a question either, but I loved your talk too. I thought it was wonderful. But it made me think that part of the work of being a writer is discovering what the page holds for you. And you've certainly done that brilliantly, and other writers do too. But it made me see it differently.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We started to talk more about it, but I was just going to invite you to talk more about the installation that you did. I was really intrigued by that, the fabric on the fence. And it seemed to be all invasive species. That's the theme, I guess. And so how many did you do? Where did you choose the fabric for some reason, or the color for some reason? It's interesting that it's in cursive, and some of the letters are so hard in cursive. Like, the S and the B to the U is like, I'm just fascinated. Like, why? Just talk more about those choices.
Sure. Yeah. Do you want me to go back to that slide again and look at it again? So, I should thank Sunny Kerr, who's here, who is the curator of this exhibit. Thank you. It's called The Ones That Made Landfall, and you're right. I can't remember if I did five or six now. I think five. But it was, dandelion, clover, mullein, burdock, starling. Yeah. And, you know, even that term you just used is interesting, invasive species, right? Because, like, the plants are innocent, right? They didn't invade, like, people did, and they brought them. At different instances, actually, like, starlings were a relatively recent 19th century, I think, introduction. Like, you know, dandelions came out, like, very with early settlers. But I was thinking about... these species are all there, like all the ones that I named are in that field. And as I started to research, I found that not only that, they're in the majority, like the grass itself is a European grass. Like they're, that field is a colonized field, or I don't know the exact term that I would use, but that's a reality to kind of look at. And at the same time, you know, there's just a lot of complexity to that situation. Some of those plants are medicine, and their medicine for, you know, indiscriminately for all of us. Like, how to work with that is not, I don't hear any absolute rules for it, except to proceed with sensitivity and respect and conversation with each other on, you know, where are we at? And of course, like, as a writer, I was thinking about the language in relation to that. You know, here we have these mostly English words. Obviously, dandelion has a French root. I think mullein is, like, it was introduced by Greek settlers originally. I'm not sure of the etymology of that word at the moment. I'm sure I looked it up at the time. But I was thinking about the tension between, say, I want to bring this language closer to the land. I live here, and I'm speaking English, and how do I get those to reconcile? But also, I'm doing it on a fence, because that is the, that's how it arrived, and that's still how it's used so often. Yeah.
Any other questions for the speaker, Sydney?
Sorry, my voice is kind of gone, so I hope you can hear me okay.
I can hear you, yeah.
You spoke a little bit about the responsibility of the page, and at one point you were talking about the writing being the thing that is always kind of representing, or is not able to not represent the thing it signifies, and how the goal of writing is to get as closely represent the thing as possible with language. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to the idea of writing for, who you're writing for, or who you, if there's someone in mind when you're writing, or how to kind of thinking about effectively communicating with metaphors, and how that works in conjunction with responsibility, or in conjunction with communication and the social element of sharing. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is that's part of getting to know your own page, right? Is knowing and always interrogating what you put down, as far as where did that word come from? What is the origin of that metaphor? You know, before you know it, you're invoking baseball or the military or something, and really you just think you're just using an expression. That's important, right? I mean, as far as who to write towards, it's funny. I remember, Phil Hall's a poet who was one of the originators of this series, and I remember sitting in a talk with him and him being asked, do you think about your audience or readership? And he said, I don't think about you at all. And I, it's haunted me since then. I've had to come to terms with that comment over many years, because I thought, well, I do. Is there something wrong with that? And I've decided there isn't. you are collaborating with the reader in the end. You're always meeting them partway. That's what writing is. And as to how much and how easy you want to make it for people, that's a decision every time. And sometimes I don't actually know until I see something read, which is interesting too, because in my work, I occupy this interesting space, being mixed race, and I'm well versed in white culture and conversation, but I'm also outside of it. I'm speaking often in the same piece to different readers that way, and sometimes I see that play out as you've heard the expression writing should disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. I've heard it attributed to David Foster Wallace, but I think that's wrong actually. Anyway, that's an expression that I found. Sometimes the same piece of writing, I watch it have a different effect depending on where I'm reading. I'm in Kingston and I see it disturb the comfortable. And then I'm at York with a different, audience, younger people who are mostly from immigrant families, and I see it comforting the disturbed, to paraphrase a bit. But it's interesting to see that you can layer those things into the same work.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jane.
Thank you, Sadeka. This was so gorgeous. This was really powerful.